Good afternoon, and welcome to the 491st meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Since its founding in 1983, the forum has met monthly to hear from an invited speaker on a topic central to U.S. foreign policy. At today's meeting, we are pleased to have Dr. Christina Babro speaking on Ice in the Mediterranean, Frozen Conflict in Cyprus. Christina Babro served for 3 decades in diplomacy, foreign affairs, and intelligence from both Washington, D.C. and in the field, complementing academic research with experience as a diplomat and intelligence analyst. Dr. Babro established herself as an expert on domestic politics and foreign policy of the Republic of Turkey and on the Aegean and Eastern Mediterranean region. During the Obama administration, Dr. Babro served in the White House as director for Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus at the National Security Council. In that role, she coordinated efforts across all agencies and departments of government on topics ranging from agricultural disputes to missile deployments. She subsequently led the CIA analytic team focused on global religious issues, demographics, and on the Eastern Mediterranean. She then managed the global programs for the CIA's Directorate of Analysis. Over the course of her career, she provided analytic support to 5 U.S. presidents, briefed members of Congress, prepared and provided the Secretary of State's daily intelligence briefing, and served as acting Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Europe. Dr. Babro has a PhD from Georgetown University and master's and bachelor's degrees from Georgetown University. She has studied at Bosphorus University in Istanbul, the University of Vienna in Austria, and the University of Maine. Dr. Babro has lived in Austria, Germany, and Turkey, and has traveled extensively in Africa, Asia, and Europe. She speaks Turkish, German, and French, and from talking to her earlier, I can assure you she also speaks English. And she was pleased to move back to her hometown of Farmington, Maine in 2025. Christina, welcome to the Midcoast.
Thank you, George. And thank you to all the members of the Midcoast Forum who are gathered here today. It's a real honor to be able to join you and share some thoughts about the Republic of Cyprus and the conflict that exists on the island. When I conceived of the title for this talk, it was, last fall, and I was thinking, what might make sense in Maine in February when we're talking about frozen conflict. And so ice in the Mediterranean, let me just clarify from the outset, we're not talking about federal agents in any regard. This is about frozen conflict, a specific example to discuss with you. George, thank you for that kind introduction. I won't recap what you said, but I did spend 29 years in the federal government across 3 different agencies, and it was at the time that I was at the National Security Council where I had my closest engagement with the issues in this frozen conflict. So, today, let's talk about first, what is frozen conflict? That's going to be the starting point for this conversation. And then I will share with you the background of one particular frozen conflict, and that's often referred to as the Cyprus problem. And then finally, I will take a look at where things go from here. This has been a long-standing conflict. Most people date it at 1974, arguably. The UN peacekeepers were present on the island about 10 years before that. So the fact that this conflict, this frozen conflict, persists today is testament to how knotty a problem it is. But we'll also look at some of the more optimistic developments on the island. This photograph on the wall shows the sign saying no entry, UN buffer zone, and a UN peacekeeper bicycling past it. This is emblematic of the division across the entire island. We'll get to that in a minute, but first let's touch on what is a frozen conflict, really. I'll propose that there are a few main qualities that are common to most frozen conflicts. There is a ceasefire, but no peace. We will see unresolved core issues. There will be a stalemate, a sense of neither side is able or willing to move, and so we're sort of stuck, and that's why we call it a frozen conflict. Those parties in a frozen conflict are often either states or de facto states, and we'll see that here as well. And we also often see external involvement by other states, other actors, such as the UN, sometimes the United States, sometimes other actors. So some examples of frozen conflict in the world, you'll recognize some of these. North and South Korea is often cited as a frozen conflict. Taiwan in its relationship with China. Kashmir, a disputed region between India and Pakistan. And South Ossetia and Abkhazia, these are two separate breakaway regions from the Republic of Georgia. And this last one that I've included is Transnistria, which is a breakaway of Moldova. There are other examples. I'm not really expert on any of these other ones, but I would propose that the kinds of elements that we'll see and talk about today in Cyprus are often evident or have parallels in these other frozen conflicts. First, let's make sure that we all know what part of the world we're talking about. Cyprus resides in the middle of the eastern side of the Med. So it's right at the crossroads between Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. Zooming in a little further, we can see how close it resides to Turkey, which is directly north of it. To the south, we have both Israel and Egypt. To the east, we have Lebanon and Syria, all very close to Cyprus. And then to the west, a bit further away, is Greece. And Greece consists of many islands, so it's not quite as far away as it looks, but it's quite far from Athens. This map of Cyprus can give us at least a starting point of what the political geography of the island is. So the island is shaped kind of like a left-handed fist with a finger pointing, your forefinger pointing. So that northern part of the island is divided from the south by what is referred to as the Green Line, that is the UN-controlled buffer zone, dividing about a little more than 30% of the island in the north from the Republic of Cyprus in the south. To be clear, the Republic of Cyprus is technically the whole island, but they do not really control the north. I'll also point out that in the southern region, there are two sovereign bases that are part of the United Kingdom. So this is some British territory on this island as well. That's not going to be much of this story, but just to be aware of it. And please note that that green line, that UN-controlled buffer zone, runs right through the heart of the island's capital, Nicosia. So to give a bit of modern history of Cyprus, the people of Cyprus have been quite mixed and diverse. There are two main ethnic communities, a majority of Greek Cypriots and a large minority of Turkish Cypriots. And I want to be clear that these are not Greeks and Turks, these are Cypriots, some of whom are Christian, Orthodox, and others who are Turkish-speaking Muslims. There are also communities of Armenians and Maronites and a few other groups on the island, but there's really a sense of island identity. As I said, Turkish speakers don't see themselves necessarily as Turks. They are Turkish Cypriots. Greek speakers are Greek Cypriots. So this was a patchwork population that existed across the island, and it was a British colony for 82 years until 1955. And as the Brits ceded control of the island to the Maine communities, they helped create a meticulous power-sharing arrangement between the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots. They had one constitution, but they had parallel electoral systems, and they had very careful power-sharing terms. There were some ideologies on the island that were not majority views necessarily, but there was the Turkish language concept of taksim, which promoted the idea of division of the island between Greece and Turkey. And there was a Greek concept called enosis, which was referring to the idea that the island should be united with, become a part of Greece. So at this time, Greece and Turkey were new members of NATO and were not, no one was looking to intensify conflict between those two parties who have always had tense relations. So together with the United Kingdom, Greece and Turkey signed what was called the Treaty of Guarantee that would ensure that there were, that according to the Constitution, there were guarantor states that would take responsibility for the well-being of the islanders. Things started to fall apart pretty quickly as the majority Greek Cypriots sidelined minority Turkish Cypriots. Communal violence began to escalate. And as I mentioned earlier, the UN peacekeepers arrived on the island as early, I think, as 1964. But in 1974, we had a situation where the military junta in Athens urged a coup on the island of Cyprus, and the group that conducted that coup arrested the president, who at the time was Archbishop Makarios III. They imprisoned him, and they installed a pro-enosis leader, so a leader who wanted to ensure that Cyprus became a part of Greece. Turkey, at that point, cited its rights under the Treaty of Guarantee to conduct a military intervention on the island. Sometimes this is referred to as invasion. You might hear me say the word invasion, but I do want to highlight that the language is sensitive because Turkey maintains that its action in 1974 was legal under the Treaty of Guarantee. The ethnic unmixing that happened as Turkey arrived on the island from the north, the military came in, and it drove thousands of people to their respective enclaves. People left behind their family properties and went to where they felt safer. A UN estimate of the number of Greek Cypriots that left behind their homes, their family properties, is about 165,000 people who were driven south. And at the same time, Turkish Cypriots were also driven north because they did not feel safe surrounded by Greek Cypriots, and that the UN estimates about 45,000 Turkish Cypriots were displaced. That coup government only lasted 8 days. Turkey has been there ever since. The UN moved to establish a zone, a buffer zone, between the Turkish-controlled north and the Republic of Cyprus in the south. In this picture, you can see Turkish troops arriving in the northern city of Kyrenia. It is an absolutely beautiful city. There's a historic citadel right there in the photograph that you can see. It still stands today, of course. Greece withdrew from NATO's military structure as a response to the Turkish action. And they did not rejoin the military structure within NATO for another 6 years. So let me share how things have gone for the two sides of this, for the two parties on the island, because there are many sides, many participants in this conflict. But let's talk about the Republic of Cyprus, which is the name of the internationally recognized country. It's the legitimate authority on the island, and it is where the Greek Cypriots live. And the Republic has really leveraged its location at the crossroads of Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. It's grown a lot. It's created an identity for itself that is has focused on becoming a financial hub. And the Republic of Cyprus was able to meet most, I would say most of, the standards for EU membership and became an EU member in 2004. And the one standard that it really didn't meet, that the EU made an exception for, was that its territorial boundaries should not be in dispute. The EU made a mistake on that one in my mind, but the Republic of Cyprus has been a place of growth and wealth and modernization since then. And in this photograph, you can see the pedestrian zone in downtown Nicosia, which looks a lot like it did when in the times that I've been there. Lively, lots of people, it's kind of bustling. And then the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, which on this slide is in quotes, and that is part of the policy of the United States government, that we have to keep this in quotes, the TRNC, because we do not recognize the entity that is the Turkish-controlled part of the island. So this is recognized only by Turkey, the TRNC. It's completely diplomatically isolated. And in this photograph, to contrast with the previous one, this is also in the same city. This is the northern part of Nicosia, Lefkosa, and you can see it's very quiet. And this, too, is what I noticed right away when I cross into the north, is that there you sort of leave behind this bustling modern city and you step back in time. To quote Rebecca Bryant, while the Republic of Cyprus holds the legal high ground on the island, the TRNC holds literal ground, and they have about 36% of the island. That used to be out of proportion with the percentage of the population in 1974 when the Turks came in. I should mention that the percentage of the island's population in 1974 was only 18.4% Turkish Cypriots, and they have 36% of that land. That percentage has evolved over the years. I'll talk about that in a little bit. Economic data for the north are unreliable, but the unemployment level is significantly higher than the Republic's 4.1%. GDP per capita is roughly half that of the Republic. It's really been affected by the devaluation of the Turkish lira. Food inflation in 2022 was close to 100%. I think that's year over year. Turkey spends about $600 million every year to support the TRNC, and that financial lifeline gives Turkey enormous leverage over the TRNC. Population is changing. So again, data on this are unreliable, but through a steady stream of subsidized Turkish settlers from the Republic of Turkey, the population of the north may now be about the same as the percentage of the land that they hold. So there may be as many as 36% of the population of the island reside in the North Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. So these Turkish settlers are culturally and religiously different from the heritage islanders. They tend to be more rural, farming poor. They tend to be more religiously observant than the more secular Turkish Cypriot Muslims. There's also a really interesting dynamic in that that finger on that left-handed map of Cyprus. That's called the Karpas Peninsula. And in that area, there remain some small communities of Greek Cypriots who live within the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. Their legal status is pretty tenuous. They have distinct identification cards from their TRNC neighbors. They're not allowed to vote in TRNC elections, even if they chose to, because they don't recognize the TRNC government. And for the latter part of the 20th century, they didn't have freedom of movement. They weren't allowed to teach their children in the Greek language. So they might have left, but it turns out that the Republic of Cyprus has really valued their presence in the north and has subsidized them with stipends and food aid to keep them as a bargaining chip in the negotiations. So the basis for negotiations between the parties was a concept called bizonal, bicommunal federation. And what does this mean? This is a really important term, which is why I put it on the slide, bizonal, bicommunal federation. It's kind of a mouthful. And what it means is that there is the consent of both communities for a new federal arrangement. And since the 1970s, this has been the basis for negotiations, and it was a starting point for all parties, the communities on the island, and the three guarantor powers, Turkey, Greece, and the United Kingdom. For decades, what the parties had agreed to, or what they agreed on in principle, was this bizonal, bicommunal federation, and that's basically it. The principal sticking points of the negotiations have involved constitution and power sharing. So what sort of government would a solution entail? Traditionally, that stated desire has been for a bizonal, bicommunal federation, but how does that work in practice? Second, security. Turkey maintains some 40,000 troops on the island, and more recently, they've announced a big increase to that number. Is there a phased transition to get the Turkish troops off the island? How many troops might be acceptable, and for how long? Territory and property rights is another of the core sticking points. How much land should a post-settlement north control? And what about the people, or now the descendants of the people, who were forced to abandon their property? These have been the principal challenges for negotiations, but there are so many more. How to share profits from the natural gas found in Cypriot waters? How to manage the Turkish Turks, the Turks from the Republic of Turkey, who have been settled on Cyprus by the Turkish government and have led to a new generation of island-born but culturally different residents of the north? Another big one is that given that the Republic of Cyprus is an EU member, is there any way to structure things so that the inclusion of the Turkish Cypriot minority does not take away from what the Greek Cypriots of the Republic of Cyprus currently enjoy within the EU? The picture here is of the hills of north of Nicosia. This picture is taken from the Greek Cypriot side, probably from the Hilton Hotel. And what you see spread out across the hillside is in chalk a Turkish Cypriot flag on the right, and on the left, a Turkish crescent and star, reminiscent of the Turkish flag, that has a quote underneath it from Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was the founder of the modern Republic of Turkey. And that quote says, "Happy is he who calls himself a Turk." And the really fun thing about this this display is that it not only taunts the Greek Cypriots during the daytime, it lights up at night. So some key moments in the negotiations over the years. In 2004, citizens of the island were offered a chance to resolve their decade-long division in the form of the Annan Plan, which was named for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who was really driving hard for a solution to this problem. It was based on a bizonal, bicommunal federation. And the Turkish Cypriots had long been understood to be the more intransigent party on the island under the decades-long hardline leadership of Rauf Denktaş. However, the When the reunification prospects came to referendum, the Turkish Cypriots voted overwhelmingly in favor of it. Greek Cypriots, who had been perceived to be more flexible, soundly rejected it. In that moment, the Greek Cypriots already had their imminent membership into the European Union locked in. It hadn't begun, but its start date had been decided. They were going to be members of the EU with or without the island status resolved. And that fact may have given hardliners in the Republic an additional edge. In this photograph, we see some women holding up flags and signs recalling the missing people of 1974. And they are also holding up signs that in Greek read "ohi," which means no. And that was the symbol of opposition to the Annan plan. Moving on, another key moment in the years, in the mid-teens, the discovery of offshore gas fields around Cyprus helped catalyze new energy to a potential solution on the island. Vice President Biden, mindful of our politically strong Greek-American population and looking for a foreign policy win ahead of his own presidential ambitions, went to Cyprus to push toward a breakthrough. I was with him on that delegation. The goal was to establish confidence-building measures. It wasn't to bring about a solution, but it was to establish confidence-building measures between the two sides that could help create some degree of trust for taking on the bigger questions that would come in a solution. In that effort, we got less than we had hoped, but we did make some progress, and importantly, the next year, the Turkish Cypriots elected a pro-solution leader by the name of Mustafa Akıncı. And under Akıncı's leadership in the north, the sides on the island engaged seriously enough to warrant deep negotiations, which came to pass in Crans-Montana, Switzerland, in 2017 under UN auspices. All five parties were there: the Turkish Cypriots, Greek Cypriots, Greece, Turkey, and the United Kingdom, hosted by Secretary General Gutierrez. These negotiations were getting somewhere. It was really exciting. The parties were engaging in the core bones of contention that had plagued this conflict for the previous four decades. From this moment of possibility, it all collapsed. A week of constructive negotiations descended into drama and shouting, and at 2 a.m., Secretary General Gutierrez called a halt. There have been no formal negotiations since. An informal meeting in April 2021 of those five parties plus the UN, it was a disaster. The parties couldn't even agree on the framework to use for talks. So talks really have been dead in the water. So what does moving forward look like now? In October of last year, the Turkish Cypriots elected a pro-solution leader. And it's easy to see why, because with a solution to the Cyprus problem, the settlers would stop flowing in from Turkey, the north would be part of the EU, and all the citizens of the island will benefit from what seems to be promised as Cyprus develops its offshore gas fields in the next 10 years. This new Turkish leader, Tufan Erhürman, met with the Greek Cypriot president Nikos Christodoulides in late 2025, in December. And the outcome suggested a thawing and a renewed prospect for engagement. And you can see in this photo, this is the Turkish Cypriot leader on the left, the Greek Cypriot president on the right, and the new UN special envoy shaking hands and smiling broadly. And it seems very warm and positive and a moment of hope, but they have a problem. Turkey disagrees. Turkey no longer supports a bizonal bicommunal federation. After decades of formally supporting a unification model on the island, in 2020, the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, publicly announced that they were not going to waste another 50 years on unsuccessful negotiations. Now Erdogan openly favors a two-state solution. If the TRNC became a recognized state, Turkey would have a client state that would also presumably vote with them in international forums. And I wouldn't underestimate this angle. They would consider themselves to have won over Greece, over the EU, and over years of international disapproval. Turkey is not alone in their opposition to renewed negotiations. However, there are still hardline Greek Cypriots who also oppose new talks. I'd like to add that in August of 2025, Turkey announced more than doubling its troop presence on the island and raised the rank of its commanding officer on the island. So that's really not a signal that bodes well for resolution anytime soon. I'm going to quote a former professor of mine, Charles King, who said that war is the engine of state building, but it's also good for business. I'm going to propose a modification to that for today, and that is frozen conflict is the engine of state building, but it too is also good for business. So in the past, the expectation associated with this unresolved conflict are both harmful to the people who live under them and profitable for those who can take advantage of them. The people living in the north are under a precarious status, living on an island that is now entirely part of the EU, but with very little prospect of accessing those advantages. And people are looking for workarounds that will enable their own economic growth and security. People look to make use of the resources that they have, and one of those resources is land. In the past, the expectation that the displacements of 1974 would one day be returned or compensated what was the prevailing norm. That was the expectation. In the early 2000s, a British couple had built a villa on contested property in the north, and they eventually had to tear it down. After the displaced Greek Cypriot owners battled it out in the courts. At that time, the authorities in the north were invested in upholding the law as determined by the European Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Justice. And so the future of former Greek Cypriot properties in the north remained in limbo. In some ways, the lack of a credible process toward unification lifted constraints. The rejection of the Annan Plan by the South in 2004, the demise of Turkey's EU membership prospects over the years, and the collapse of negotiations in 2017 has shifted, I would argue, incentives on the island. Now, property developments are going up. In this photograph, you can see new building. This is in the north. This is overlooking the city of Kyrenia. These are new villas. Foreign investors know that they are unlikely to ever be forced from the land. There is a construction boom on the island, and Northern Cyprus was even number one in an article in Forbes, best beachfront buys in 2021. And they didn't mention anything about the legal challenges. No one's afraid of losing their property at this point. So these developments may bring in wealth. They may help the people in the north in some ways, but they are also making permanent changes to the status quo on the island, and they deepen the divide going forward. There are more positive developments as well. A sense of Cypriotness persists on the island, and there's a desire to move beyond the institutional structures that may be obstructing progress. Socially, it's loosened up. I heard recently about a Greek Cypriot journalist who shared that his kid's in a rock band with some Turkish Cypriot kids. I think that's pretty cool. But there are other joint projects. A really important one is the Committee for Missing Persons. And this is an organization that consists of Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot scientists who work together in the buffer zone, the UN buffer zone, on identifying the remains of exhumed bodies from the conflict. And so they are involved in identifying burial sites. They are involved in collecting the remains, and they collect DNA from people who have unaccounted for loved ones. And through DNA testing, they are able to return remains to families. They were established in the 1980s, and they had about 2,000 people that they were looking to identify. And I think at this point, they've identified about 50% of the people they were looking to they are not looking to assign blame or responsibility for the deaths. They are simply looking to give families closure on what has been lost. Marine archaeology is another cool place. And the preservation of the Kyrenia shipwreck, this was the best preserved example of a ship pulled from the seafloor in 1964. It's become an archetype of classical and Hellenistic period, and it's become a symbol of the Republic's rich cultural heritage. It also resides in the north, and so it has other meaning for the TRNC because it's a tourist draw. It brings in people who want to see that history, and the people from both communities have worked together on the preservation of that. Protecting historical sites is another one, but allow me to highlight this photograph of a man at a piano. He is conducting a choir. This is a bi-communal choir that meets every Wednesday afternoon to sing in the Green Zone. They sing Cypriot traditional songs in both Turkish and Greek, and I love that picture. It's extraordinary. Cyprus remains a place of contradiction, rigidity and adaptability, coexistence and conflict. Resolution, particularly at an institutional level, may be as far away now as it ever has been. People who have lost their homes may never get them back, and a large minority of people do live in a legal gray zone. Even so, connections like these examples provide a model for persistence under difficult circumstances. Thank you very much for your kind attention, and I'm really looking forward to hearing questions and comments from other folks here. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Christina. This is one of those seemingly intractable problems that the world is good at. While we collect questions from the audience, I'd like to ask a question or two of my own. You talked a lot about the Turkish presence in northern Cyprus and the fact that they've introduced troops and all, but you didn't talk much about the southern part, the Greek Cypriot part, the Republic of Cyprus. What role does Greece play in that? And then a second question, which is very related in my mind at least, is where does Cyprus play in the conflict between Greece and Turkey? Is it a real flashpoint, or is it just kind of something that's off to the side?
The first question about is there a counterpart to the Turkish military presence in the north? Is there a counterpart to that in the south? And I think the key difference here is that the Republic of Cyprus is its own country. It is an internationally recognized country that has its own military. It is a member of the EU. There is a Greek presence on the island, a military presence. It's about, I think about 900 people. It may be fewer than that, but it is not handled the same way in the Republic as it is in the North. And the second question,
where does this play? What role does this play in the Greek-Turkish animosity?
Yeah, the relationship between Greece and Turkey has been a really fraught one over the years, despite the fact that both parties are members of the NATO alliance. They nearly came to blows in 1996 over a contested island. And so I think that tension goes far beyond Cyprus. It's not about Cyprus. Cyprus is potentially a potential flashpoint. It certainly has been a flashpoint in the past, in 1974, with the Turkish intervention and the Greek withdrawal from the military structure of NATO. But I think Greek and Turkish tensions are much more encompassing than just the island.
I understand that. Here's someone who had a question similar to one I had, and that is, there's now a strong division between the Greek and the Turkish Cypriots. Were at one time their culture, that the cultures mixed? I mean, what happened during the time when the British, when the were in charge? Was there a lot of disagreement in that time? Or?
I think the answer is yes to both. It was a mixed society, and there were tensions between members of the communities, but it also varied. You knew your neighbor, and you lived together. So I think that separation that came about in 1974 was very painful, with many people having to leave behind what they knew. It highlighted that they did not feel safe where they were, but I think it was and this is not a time period that I know super well, but my read on it was that they were managing for a long time to live together. There are still mosques that are exist in the south. There are still cathedrals that exist in the north, or churches. So that's a remnant of a past history.
And then at the end, you talked about the fact that the new villas being built in the north, etc. What's happening in the south? Is the same thing happening? That the properties of those who moved north is now kind of open for anyone?
That's a great question, and it's one that I don't really know a lot about, because the contested land, the focus on land that is contested is really focused on the north, where the Republic of Cyprus does not have actual control over what happens. The land, the properties in the south, what happened to them was governed by the law of the Republic of Cyprus. I know less about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then someone wanted you to talk a little more about the gas fields that are being discovered. Are they being discovered around the island, or off the shore of the Turkish part, of Turkish Cypriot part, or the, and what then is the, what is this, how does this enter into the whole conflict?
So I think there was real hope that the discovery of these gas fields, some of which reside between Cyprus and Israel, it's further south between Cyprus and Egypt, and I believe that there have been some discoveries to the west of Cyprus as well, that there was a hope that that would provide an incentive to create support for reunification of the island, and that it's hard to see how that happens now. because the Turks are so opposed to agreement. They've actually sent some of their own ships to conduct exploratory soundings in the waters off of Cyprus, which is challenging the local authority for sure. The development, if it is successful, and there are huge hurdles to successfully developing these oil fields, because even if there is, they are able to tap the gas from the sea floor, they have to figure out how are they going to transport it. Do they build a pipeline north to Turkey? Probably not. Do they build a pipeline to Egypt or Israel? Do they try to ship it? So there are a lot of hurdles there. And last I heard was that Chevron is taking the lead on an international consortium to assess the viability of these gas fields. And they should have an answer. I think the timeline is in the next year, 18 months. So but trying to figure out how citizens on the north side of the island would benefit from that, it's hard to see why. What's the incentive for the Republic to share?
Someone would like to know what the current policies are. Has the Trump administration taken any interest in Cyprus thus far, or is it just something that hasn't come on their radar screen yet?
So the administration has not taken a great deal of interest in the island. I think one area that is intriguing is the presence of Russian money on the island. So Nicosia in the Republic of Cyprus and some of the resort cities in the south were places where a lot of Russian money resided. A lot of oligarchs like to have their villas on Cyprus. It was below the radar, it was out of the way. And over the years, particularly with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the EU has put increasing pressure on the Republic of Cyprus to evict those Russians from the benefits of the Republic of Cyprus. And it took a while, but they have done so. They've really cracked down on Russian money in the south. And so where do they go? Where might the law be a little more flexible, a little more willing to turn a blind eye? So I think we've seen not just Russians, but wealthy investors or other sorts of rich types taking up residence in the north, investing in that legal gray zone. That might eventually become interesting to our government, but maybe not to push for any change.
So you've already, I think, answered most of this question. Is it accurate to say that Cyprus has become a place of the world's hyper wealthy, and or wealthy and for banking, or money launderers and their assets?
I think that was a big source of wealth for the Republic of Cyprus until the EU adapting to the EU norms really has pushed for change there. That was painful to the economy of the Republic of Cyprus. If you're looking to launder money, there are other places to go nearby.
Someone wanted to expand a little bit on why Turkey still insists on there being a Turkish Republic in Cyprus. I know you said it would be another nation that could support them, but isn't it more of a headache than the territory might be worth?
That's a great point. So far, it doesn't seem to have been the headache factor doesn't seem to have been a deterrent. Turkey has been willing to send its troops, and it's a lot of money to Northern Cyprus to keep it afloat, to keep up this fiction that it is truly an independent country recognized only by Turkey. Sometimes there has been talk that this might become a province of Turkey, that might be sort of the next province, but I don't think that is part of Turkey's vision. That would it's more useful to Turkey to keep the Turkish Cypriot identity and distinct, and to push for a two-state solution at this point.
And then some little broader questions, but what if NATO, for some reason, strange reason, falls apart, or there becomes a conflict? I guess the main question is, what's likely to move this from a frozen conflict to a real conflict? Are there some things that could happen that could turn this into a real, conflict as opposed to its current status?
So I think there is always that risk. I think what the NATO dimension is interesting is that by having these rival countries, Greece and Turkey, embedded in the NATO architecture, it has been useful. It has been a way of tamping down that rivalry and pushing back against impulses to create disruption on the island. And I think perhaps what I might suggest with regard to Turkey's announcements 6 months ago, that they were more than doubling the number of troops on the island, is that we may be abdicating our role in tamping down those impulses and pushing for constructive engagement.
And someone wanted to go out a little bit outside your direct area of expertise and ask if you would classify the Israeli-Palestinian conflict now as a frozen conflict. Sounds like some of the same core sticking points are identical in terms of land and religion and all of that.
That's certainly been a much hotter zone than Cyprus has been, that's why I wanted to share the slide earlier about what kinds of qualities exist in frozen conflicts, so that when we look at things in other parts of the world, we can see where are they similar, where are they different. I think it's interesting to note that people in the Republic of Cyprus often portray themselves as really having been victimized by 1974. Many people really did have real loss of life, loss of property, and the grief and the grievances are authentic. I think it loses a little bit of its emotional impact when they compare themselves to the Palestinians. What happened in 1974 was awful. It is not on the same scale.
Fair enough. Then finally, to broaden and take a little advantage of your knowledge of Turkey as well, this is not about Cyprus, but it's about Turkey. Could you speak about Turkey's efforts to support Ukraine, especially and early in the war, to ensure that its exports could continue? And will Erdogan continue this support and help rebuild? Erdogan is certainly wanting to play a much bigger role in the affairs of countries in that region.
That's true. They have sought to play a much bigger role. Turkey has a very challenging and interesting location just geographically. They control the entrance to the Black Sea. And so their relationship as a member of NATO and as someone that has a party that has to engage constructively with Russia simply to allow Russian access to its own coast, or to limit NATO access to what has been agreed upon by the parties. It puts them in a very delicate position. I haven't been following this as closely for the last few years, so I think I will defer on the rest of that question. Okay. Not as all prepared right. for that one.
Thank you very much. I think very much appreciate.
Thank you.